Welcome to Legal Trailblazers, where we talk about black lawyers and their role in the ushering in of the constitutional democracy that South Africa enjoys today. I'm your host, Tuto Radebe. I am honored today to interview Mamuno Mvuyo and Mamuno Sizwe, the daughters of the late advocate Duma Nokwe. Thank you, ladies, for making time to conduct this interview with us. Let's start off with the background, your dad's background. I understand he was born in Everton.
That's correct.
But he is a Pondo.
Very interesting question, because Obu Pondo, we only learned about it when we were in exile, when Budada and
the late J.B. Marks.
J.B. Marks. He used to call us Amantombazana wasemampondweni. And Daddy didn't elaborate, you know, what that meant, because he was such a nationalist, and to be, you know, sort of grouped in a tribal way, that was not him. So he never brought us up to think that we were Mpondos or anything. We just spoke isiXhosa, and that's it. And yes, he was born in Everton, grew up in Everton. His parents, both parents came from Everton, Otatumkulu and Umakulu. That's how they met, in Everton. Nothing more. So that's why everybody says, Kanine, Nina Nivelapi.
Yes.
And we're like, Joburg.
Yes.
So because it is only now when, with a little bit, our other sister, Ozana, Mvulazana, when she worked in Mtata at Ekwezi Lokusa as a physiotherapist, that she met Utsinga Nokwe. And Utsinga then sort of gave us the history of where we are coming from. But in essence, I think that we're told we're coming from Wanongo.
Oh, is that possible?
Because if you remember, the Shaka Zulu upheavals happened, and a lot of those indigenous people moved away. We don't even know. Itamankulu, my sister went there, Uzana, because one of the legal fraternity family friends passed away. So, you know, because he's also a Nokwe. And the thing that we liked about all this is that in terms of our, background, so we link up with anybody who is a Tswanini, Mia, Mja, Smiu. So Utsinga was lecturing to us about all these, you know, where our origins are from.
Yes. The Bondoland Heritage, is it organization or council, awarded your father, or they honored your father. You received that award. How did that come about?
Very interesting too, because I was approached by Her Royal Highness Stella Stau, and when she said to us, look, we have an award for your father. Your father is going to receive posthumously this award as a brave person who has fought human rights and all those. So one of the family members should receive it. So fortunately, I was then the High Commissioner of South Africa in Mauritius, so I was able to go down there and receive the award. But I also didn't know that it would be also for myself. It's also an award that I got as one of the, you know, the princesses there that gave me the award. So we were truly honored, because, you know, it's rare occasions that somehow our father is being recalled in post-independent South Africa. And that award for us was very valuable. And we appreciated the Royal Highness as well as the Pondo, Royal Family. So we are, you know, looking forward to all that, because I think the Pondo Festival is coming up again in September. it was hit also by the COVID, so they couldn't, you know, do anything. But I think they did it online. I also appeared online because also their other focus is gender-based violence.
Which is important. Mm-hmm.
Very
important.
That issue
is here. Yeah. Is this festival held every year in September?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
So we also got to know more about your cultural roots.
That's a fact, because I was so taken aback that I don't know if you've been to, you know, the Xhosa, you know, areas where, even where Ukunu, where Tata Mandela is buried, beautiful landscape. And I can feel, you know, equally feel and understand why Utata wanted to be buried there, because it's hills and I don't know how to describe it, but it's just awesome, you know. So I was honored to go there and, you know, pay that respect, as well as, you know, attend and see how the cultural norms are. So it's enlightening. And I think we as a family, at one time we used to gather together and, you know, trace all those Mias, because also we are aligned to Utu Nokwe, the musician, and her family. We're very close, and we are still close, you know. So we are trying to trace our roots. You know, as you say, if you don't know where you're coming from, you don't know where to go.
True. And Sisno Zizwe, have you ever been there, that side of the Eastern Cape yourself?
I haven't.
What did you find there?
I haven't been to Pondoland as such, but I've been to, let's say, the main cities like Gqeberha, East London. But I haven't been. My sisters are the ones who are actually doing the, the official visits when they're invited by either the Royal Highnesses or when there's an occasion of the Mias. My sister Mvulazana, she always goes. I haven't been there as well.
Are you the last one in the family?
I am the last of the girls, and then after me there's a boy, my baby brother.
Yes. Your mom, where is he from?
Good question.
Not much is known about your mom. What was her name, her full name, and her maiden surname?
Thank you for asking that. In fact, that's also a family sort of a squabble, because our nephew, Uzolile, when we talk about Utata, he says, look, I don't know that dude, you know, but I know Umakuluwam, Uvuiswa, Malangabi. She hails from Cape Town. You know, so that's why we don't know much about the hinterland of our country, because our parents were more urbanized. So Umama Yena is from Cape Town, and that's why I think Uzolile was very much close to Umama, because he stayed and lived with Umama. Mama was a fascinating woman, and as I'm sure Nosizwe will highlight also, is that she was so studious that she went to Hilltown, she went to the University of Fort Hare, she did botanical zoology and all those fancy things that you can think of, and that's how she met Utata in Fort Hare. And actually, Mama is the one who introduced Tata into the African National Congress.
How is that?
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
Little is known, and that's the thing about any struggle that has women behind it. You always hear the male voices, but you don't hear the women behind it. And those are the things that need to be highlighted, so that probably, going back to the roots of this gender-based violence, it has its roots in also in this patriarchal state of what we're having. And indeed, you know, we need to recognize that and ensure that our boy children need to respect their mothers, their aunties, their, you know, any female, you know. So that, because I don't know why this thing, the scourge, is going up and up, but that's not the subject of today.
Yes. your mom was a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Where did she work?
That's an interesting thing, because I think, as you say, mom, yes, left the college. She did a teacher's college, like Umam Utata. They did their BSc and everything else. They finished, and they were teaching. And then, of course, they were very much involved politically. Actually, the two of them were like, you know, twins. They were comrades. So when, you know, one of the occasions, Utata and herself went out, I think, on a campaign, and they were caught. So abruptly, the, you know, the regime then, you know, cut them out. So they could not teach anymore. So Umama then became a social worker, I remember, because she used to drive around, you know, going to the crèches and all these places that of, you know, under five learning. So in a way, her, what do you call it, her whole background was that. But then when we went into exile in 1965, living in Zambia, she went back into teaching. So she taught at what we call the Philip Rennie. That was the, you know, the boys' school in Zambia. Then just post independence of Zambia, 1964. So she then taught at this multiracial school. But I think she didn't feel quite there because, you know, this is a privileged school. So she went to a school which was a Phillips. I don't know, those days they gave them
Prince Philip.
Prince Philip, yes.
Oh, after Prince Philip.
Yeah, but then it changed to Kamwala High School. And there too, it was also a mixed Indian school with the Africans because it was post-independence. But I think she wasn't feeling, you know, comfortable. So in the end, she went to the underprivileged school called Madero Girls. And that's where she taught and finished. And I think that was her hallmark as well, because a lot of the students who went to Matero Girls still remember that. You know, when we bump into them, they say, oh, you're Manokwe's daughters. So yeah, they'd be so excited because she was a science teacher. You know, she did physical science, she did biology, all the sciences that are not easy to do.
Yes.
But she encouraged the young girls, and today they always say, I am what I am today because of your mother.
Oh, that's good. Did she hold any positions within the ANC before it was banned? Do you know?
Mom was that type of a person who was very private, but she did a lot. I know she worked in the offices of Utatu Nelson Mandela, you know, in downtown as a secretary. So she was also very good with typing, but also very good intellectually. Even part of the Freedom Charter, they wrote that all together. So she's very much astute, but very much reserved.
Yes.
And she didn't want to hold any position. No, she never held any of the positions.
Well, she peers with the likes of Mama Helen Josephs,
yep,
and the last one.
Yep. We know them all. Mama Ngoyi,
yes.
Auntie Albertina Sisulu.
Very close.
Very close, mm-hmm. You know. So it's a historical thing that, unfortunately, and I think it's incumbent on us as a family to bring, you know, her strength, her guiding principles and
true,
values.
True. When did they come to live in Johannesburg, your parents?
Good question. My father and mother, I think the Umama came back 1954, no, because I was born 1953, right? So she came back 1953 to live here, and we lived with Umakul, our grandmother, in Westcliff, you know, 7044. You know,
so Westcliff is Orlando West.
Yeah,
Soweto.
Orlando West, yeah, yes. That's correct. So she lived then, no, actually, that's not our first house. Our first house was, in Pumulo, apparently.
Also Orlando West, yes.
Orlando West.
Yes.
So because I was always, if you know the Sisulus, they always teased because I was called Bamboon. I don't know. I think I must have been a roly-poly or I don't know what, but I hated the name.
Yes.
And up, I'll tell you the story because when Namibia got independent in 1990,
yeah? 1990, yes.
I was then living in Ghana. And then I was asked by the delegation, yes, in Ghana, to be part of it. But I think they knew background that they would meet Utatu Nelson Mandela.
Yes.
And when Utatu Nzo, and because we all know them all, you know, so he says, he calls me and he says, and he tells Utatu Mandela, do you know whose child is this? Utatu Mandela just looked at me and just said,
Pampoon.
Pampoon. So that's when I embraced that name, and I loved it from that time, because I was like, 27 years this gentleman remembers.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I must have been small, because we left South Africa when I was 10.
Yes.
So as for me, from then on, I just loved my name.
And then in Dube, when did your family move to Dube, which is my hometown? I was born just a block away from the house.
Oh, wow.
That you used to live in. Yes.
Yeah, that's a good question, because if my chronology, that now you've given me the homework, if it will help me, because I remember Oputsindiso, we call them Butabo, the former president, Thabo Mbeki, you were part of, you know, those who helped us to, you know, transfer from Westcliff to Dube, to move to Dube. So it should have been, you know, early 60s, even before 63, because Utata left 1963 to go into exile. So
when Thabo Mbeki came to live in Soweto, in fact, when he came to live in Johannesburg, after his father, Govan Mbeki, had requested your father, Mr. Dumanokwe, to take him under his wing. He came to live in Johannesburg.
That's correct.
He came to live at your house.
At the grandmother's house.
Your grandmother's house.
Well, 7044 Westcliff.
In Orlando West.
Yeah.
Did he live in Dube, Thabo Mbeki?
He did, because I think by that time he was getting ready to escape the country. And, you know, most of the people left clandestinely. We just see them there, you know, during the day and night time, they were gone. So I think once we moved into Dube, then I never saw Oputabo again.
How old were you at the time when you came over to live with your family?
I think I must have been sort of nine-ish.
So Sis was not yet born, is it?
No, she was
I wasn't even an idea.
So you only met Thabo Mbeki when in exile in Zambia?
Yeah, I met him in Zambia.
Mm-hmm. Were you still young? What positions did your father hold in the ANC? He was a secretary general.
The youngest secretary general at the age of 33.
So Babu Alfred Nzo came after
that's
him.
Correct.
Yes.
After that 1969 Morogoro Conference.
Yes, the 1968 Morogoro, yes, in Tanzania.
Yeah.
Yes. You were already in
Osaka. Yeah.
When did you leave South Africa? The family.
Okay.
He left first.
Dada left in 1963 when more the Rivonia trialists were caught, right? And it was interesting that the ANC then said, look, we can't all be in jail, so part of you should leave. So it was Datu O.R. Tambo, Utata, J.B. Marx,
Moses Kotane,
that whole group.
J.P. Marx, Moses Mokotane were communists. Was he a communist?
Yes, he was, yeah.
Did he hide it?
No. I don't think so.
He never hid it.
No.
Yeah.
He was a communist.
No, he wasn't.
He participated openly.
I think Dada changed. He went to, you know, it's trouble with Utatu Sisulu and this delegation to
Soviet Union.
Soviet Union, China, and all those places. And when he saw that, you know, Russia, or Soviet Union then, you know, that communism, you know, the wealth is shared, you know, amongst all the people. So I thought this is an ideal establishment, because we can do the same for South Africa. So I think that's how he was sold into communism. Though that he was with the Communist Party, no, but I think he attended most of the meetings.
Did he undergo any military training there?
That's a good question.
He did.
You did?
Yeah. Where?
When the MK was formed.
Yes.
He was part of it.
Mandela was the first commander.
Yeah.
Of the Mkhonto weSizwe.
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then where did he work as a teacher? And I understand he quit teaching because of the misgivings that he had with the Bantu education as it was being introduced then at the time.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, good question. I know he taught in Randfontein, because there is also a street named after him there in Randfontein. And also at St. Peter's, because St. Peter's was also part of, you know, a lot of the young stars like Utatu Matthews and, you know, the youngsters went to school there because Utatu O.R. was the teacher there. So, Lento, when did he exactly leave? It was, I think, forced upon him, because I think Utatu Sisulu was very instrumental. Realized that, look, we need more than just teachers for our revolution. So he persuaded, you know, because Tata then changed and went to do law at Wits. So he then, because he didn't have the money, because both his parents were, you know, Umama, Utatumkulu was a cobbler, Umakulu was working in the hotels, cleaning. So Utatu Sisulu was very instrumental in that he went to his Indian friends who were living in Fortsburg and said, you know, donation here for my youngsters who need to go and study law. So that's how he got into getting to Wits to do law. So I think then he had to give up, you know, the teaching post because he needed to study and do law.
He also taught at Krugersdorp. He taught at a school in Krugersdorp, and he was part of what is called the Congress School, which was in Fortsburg. So at some point, it was decided to form a school in Fortsburg, and he was one of the teachers. He was teaching mathematics. And what's interesting is that not long ago, just before the COVID, the Congress School celebrated like its X anniversary, and we were invited to that, and it was quite amazing to find a lot of the people that he had taught, Dumanoko had taught at that school, already obviously now they are senior citizens.
Yes.
But they remembered him, and they said he taught them mathematics. And in fact, one of the gentlemen was there, had a cutting from the newspaper, which he kept in his wallet for all these years. And that cutting was saying that Dumanoko had graduated and had got his LLB. And he said this for him was such an inspiration that he decided to also go and try and study law, and eventually went and studied law in England. So it was a very telling moment. So yes, he taught, and that was, by the way, voluntary. They weren't earning any money, but they wanted to teach because also the Indian children were being discriminated against, and they were not getting the proper education.
Yes.
So him and a couple of other people who were members of the ANC and the Congress movement, they were teaching mathematics and sciences at the Congress School.
At the school in Tanzania, it was later formed by the ANC, the Solomon Mahlangu Freedom College. Mm-hmm. How instrumental was he in the formation of the school?
He had already passed by then. But Mama, our mother, was very instrumental because Umama was belonging to the committee of the education. You know,
Department of Education, yeah.
Yeah. The
within
education.
The ANC.
Within the ANC. Mm-hmm. You see, we became a government outside the, you know, South Africa, because Umama was very instrumental with Abu Maseko and
Tatu Njobe.
And Mamu Njobe, you know, all those educationists, you know. So Umama was very instrumental in that, you know. So
besides being a teacher, later on an advocate, a lawyer, Mr. Noke was also a prolific writer. He used to write a lot, to record the struggle, the life of the blacks, of the African people in Africa, and in South Africa in particular.
True. Yes, true. And I mean, he was a prolific writer as well as a reader. If you go back, I think also read from one of the, you know, telling their stories. That was Utatu, Joe Matthews. Then sort of was schooling with him at this school in Fortsburg, the St. Peter's, right? So he said Dada used to hide, you know, don't go for classes, and you'll go under the blankets and read. But do you know what he was reading? Karl Marx. So he said, afterwards, when they were, because they were both at a Forte, he says, you used to hide and read these heavy duty books. What did you understand? And I mean, he must have been like 14 or something like that. But yes, it's remarkable. And I think this is where we should take a leaf from these leaders, because they just didn't become just leaders overnight.
Yes,
they built in themselves, you know, and nurtured themselves, and you know, used to read a lot. You know, reading is very important.
Yes, and of course, as a leader in the ANC, before it's burning, I imagine he was arrested or banned because of his political activities.
Mm. That's so true. I mean now we're living in Orlando West, and what's his name? Tata was in and out of prison, as you know, and or beaten up to pulp on one occasion, I remember. And then also, he didn't live at home. He had to go underground, and that's how Nosizwe got her name as Nosizwe, Mother of the Nation, because she was born during the peak time when Mandela and all the ANC members were now, you know, sort of fighting for our liberation. So, yeah, he was very much in and out of prison, and that's why in the end he could not practice, you know, as his profession. And, you know, they targeted him quite frequently, you know.
And, of course, after qualifying as an advocate, the first African person to be admitted as an advocate in the province of Transvaal, in the then South Africa. Then he had challenges.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't, as you are saying, he couldn't practice. But when he started to practice, he encountered opposition from some members, white members of the legal profession.
Right. Yeah, and you know, if you remember that the Group Areas Act prohibited Africans to practice, you know, in a white area. And of course, as an advocate, there is a ruling that you need to be not too far from the High Court. And if you know, on Pritchard Street, where the High Court is Her Majesty's chambers, where, you know, he should have had his office. They refused him that office. They tried, even because, if you remember how he went to study law, is that, like I said, Utatu Sisulu was very instrumental. And when Tata went to Wits, he met a professor, Harlow, and who looked at him and he said, "You're wasting your time. No black man has ever passed an LLB."
This is what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nakwe. The LLB is not for people of your hue.
Wow.
That's what he said.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think this must have been a haka for Daddy.
Yes.
Because he then had to study and pass with a cum laude so that Harlow, Professor Harlow, could not fail him, you know. But now a barrier was now where to practice. But now the interesting thing is that who came to his rescue was his colleague,
George Bezos. Yes.
And he said, "Look, let's share this room." And they shared a room at His Majesty's chambers, but he could not attend or go for tea, you know. And I liked what Tata Sisulu said. He said, "We cannot be arguing over a cup of tea," you know, because so what?
There's a bigger issue here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's how he was able to befriend George Bezos. We're very close to Uncle George Bezos, and also they partnered. In fact, Uncle George Bezos is almost always in tears when he saw us, because Dada never saw the liberation of South Africa. Too is that he said he taught him human rights.
Yes.
So, yeah, he has a legacy.
So as an advocate, he used to get a lot of cases from the law firm of Mandela and Tambo,
mm-hmm.
because at the time when he started working, it was still operating.
Right.
But Mr. Mandela and Mr. Tambo were very much involved in ANC activities, so much that at the expense of their own legal practice. So I would imagine Mr. Nogwe handled a lot of their cases.
Yeah. And if you recall, is that if you're an advocate, you have a direct access to the judge. But they were attorneys, and they couldn't have that. If you look at the treason trial of 1951, where the 156 were jailed, remember, Abu Helen Joseph.
He wasn't accused there.
He was accused.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
He was later acquitted, amongst other people. They were acquitted.
Yes, but very late.
Yes.
But then I think the strategy there, you know, the ANC was a marvelous organization because they had to strategize, because they had lawyers, but their lawyers are coming from far away, and I don't know what happened. Then they said, look, to, you know, willy-nilly this case, let's, you know, abandon these lawyers. And you, Duma, you be our advocate. So he was an accused as well as an advocate.
Yes.
He was the only one who was able to talk. So together, Nabo, Helen Joseph, some other, you know, committee they constituted to come up with a case and how they're going to question, you know, each one of them, you know. So, yeah, it was an interesting thing. I kind of recall in a way and back in my memory because, yeah, it was destabilizing. But the beauty about family, you know, is that we were growing up with our grandparents, and Mama was also working full time, because she had to be the breadwinner. And is that, you know, you didn't feel that you were not, you know, you were neglected, you know, like what we are seeing now in this day. Because all these extended parents came into being. If you're not with the Sisulus or you were the Mandelas, you know, these aunties were, you know, jumping in, and you didn't feel neglected. So I think, in a way, we were rounded in that we had this big ANC family, you know, so which protected us, you know, and especially, you know, those days the regime was very brutal to our parents. So we didn't experience that brutality in such, but indirectly, I guess, yeah.
When he left for exile, he left his family behind. And then when did you follow him to exile? And how old were you then?
Okay, Daddy left 1963. And if I recall, he was under house arrest. And, you know, now everything was brewing, because I think then Tatu Nelson Mandela had become the Black Pimpernickel and had gone to Algeria and everything, because I think by then they had decided that we get into armed struggle now. It's, you know, this, you know, peaceful demonstration is not helping us.
Not working in.
Yeah. So Dada was under house arrest at home, and I recall that we had a neighbor, the Ngwenyas, who were our neighbors, immediate neighbors, because my Uzana and Upaki were going to the school. They were principals at the school. So they used to take them. So Dada would sit in his yard, and Utatu Ngwenya would sit in his yard. And Utata would be having his beer, and Utatu Ngwenya would have his tea. Then, of course, you know, the special branch would just jump in, and they said, you are not supposed to have visitors. He says, what visitors? I don't have a visitor. So they say, but you have a... He says, look, I'm in my yard, he's in his yard. So where's the visitor here? So in that way, he was able to maneuver and also to defend himself, you know. So, yes, it became very critical when Bo Tatu Sisulu, Bo Uncle Kathrada, and all the other Mbeki, Tatu Mbeki, Governor Mbeki, were caught at that Rivonia farm.
Yes.
Yes, and then that's why it's called a Rivonia trial. And Utatu Mandela had been caught when he came back, 1962. So he was already in prison. So these ones were caught in 1963. So, like I said, the leadership of the ANC said, look, you know, we can't all be in, so you guys escape. So they escaped into Botswana and they left Umama. But you know how the regime operates. Yes. Once the other partner is left behind, just like this in the Sisulu case,
yes,
the mother is the next target. So Mami was targeted, she was put under house arrest. She could not, you know, now fend for her family. So for 1963, we had a tough time, you know, because here is this breadwinner now, unable to fend for her family. It was 6-6, you know, house arrest. Then I think Mami realized, look, Nomanzo, Mrs. Nzo, realized that, look, we can't keep this, you know. So they also escaped 1964 and went into Botswana. But they waited for us in Botswana.
Oh, you joined him in Botswana?
Yeah,
we joined. And later on, you went to Lusaka?
That's correct, yeah.
So was Oliver Tambo already there in Lusaka when you came
no,
to live there? Or
because
you came later?
If you recollect, the independence of Zambia was 1964. So most of the headquarters of the African National Congress was in Tanzania. So it was in Dar es Salaam. You know, so yeah, the leadership was moving between Dar es Salaam or the UK because they had to be rallying the international, you know,
community
yes,
to drum up
yes,
in international solidarity.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Daddy was in Tanzania then. Yeah.
But he used to do a lot of traveling,
mm-hmm,
as you are saying, drumming up international support
right
for the ANC.
Mm.
In fact, he was, some people say he was a super diplomat of the ANC because he's the one who used to represent the ANC in the United Nations.
That's correct. And also to try and get the regime out of the UN. There is a famous speech that he presented at the UN of how to get, you know, the South African regime out of the UN. And I, you know, because we always had these discussions at home, when he drummed that up, then Foster was the foreign minister. Then he gets up and says, you guys, you're talking about Bantu education, you're talking about, okay, you're talking about Bantu education, you are, you know, look at this gentleman who's perfect in English, you know, so, you know, just to damper him, you know, so yeah.
There was a trip when he went to the UN in New York,
right,
representing the ANC, he was put under surveillance even there in New York by the apartheid government.
Yes, that's correct.
That's how dangerous they regarded him.
Yes.
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 No. And eventually he was banned by the United States government.
Is that so?
He became a persona non grata.
Wow, how did that happen? After the apartheid government had complained, I suppose.
He was put on the terrorist list and he was banned as a persona non grata.
So he couldn't get into...
Couldn't go back to the UN, to the United States.
That was never lifted. At the time of his death,
no,
that hadn't been lifted.
No, it hadn't been lifted.
Oh, this is...
Which is why we were so surprised when the first time I applied for an American visa, I thought I wouldn't get it because of that issue. And they do ask in that form,
yes,
have any of your family members been... You know,
yes,
from the
in that form.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I said yes, but
wait, what year was that?
When he was banned, or
when
I went?
When you went?
Or when I first applied, it was 1998 or 2000 somewhere there. First time I applied, I didn't think I'd get the visa.
Yes,
but I did.
Mm-hmm.
So he was your father was a mentor to the likes of Thabo Mbeki and others.
Yes.
Who else? Who else reported under him?
Max
as the Secretary General.
Oh, under him. Abusi Qashe.
Max. Ooh, there were so many. He was the Secretary General.
Cindy Somfenyane, you know.
Yes.
There's a whole Ubani Ujele,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Makatini, you know.
Johnny Makatini.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So that's why I think Johnny became our representative at the UN, you know, so okay. Yeah.
After your father.
Yeah.
In, he left his position 1968 after the
Morogoro conference.
Yeah, is that 69 or 68?
I think it was
68, 69. Mm-hmm. 69, yeah.
Was it due to illness or what?
No, interesting. Chris Honey and the young, because both Chris were very young, came to Daddy, because Daddy was very approachable person, you know. So they said, hey, you're not leadership, you know, you guys, this struggle is not going anywhere. You know, well, like a choo-choo train. I don't think he said choo-choo train, but it sounded like a choo-choo train that's going very slowly nowhere. So we need to do something. So Daddy says, wait, can you just go back? Because he was that type of a person. You know, he didn't dismiss it, but he just said, look, go back. Think about it. Present it to me. So they did. They said, okay, we need a conference where the leadership can be put to task, you know. So Tata then spoke to Utatu Tambo, then he was our acting president. Said, look, I think they presented a paper to him to say, look, this is the thing, the problems and issues. Because we remember at that time we also had a lot of our cadre training in Angola. So, you know, the youth were now agitated that we're getting trained, going to Russia, going to Algeria, everywhere, and we're not moving. We're not getting into South Africa. And also, it was also post, is it the Wanki?
I forgot. The Wanki campaign. Yeah.
The Wanki campaign, yeah.
Yeah, but the Wanki where a lot of our people also died because they fought with the Zipra, you know. So, Dada presented this, and then when they had the conference, they said, look, we can't stand here as leadership. We have to be down there and be par with everybody. So we're going to step down. So they stepped down. Even Tata O.R. Tambo also stepped down. But then the people said, no. Then this is going to be, you know, a fiasco. So please, Tatu O.R. Tambo, you go back and, you know, guide us and lead us. So it so happened that Tata then lost his post as the Secretary General that year, you know. He didn't feel, because he says, look, these posts are not made for us, you got to deliver. So that's when he went and did the Radio Freedom and came back to Lusaka. And actually, we were happy because we had our daddy for more time than usual. So he's opened up the Radio Freedom. But I guess Tata is such an intellect, because I think they also realized, the ANC realized that, okay, you know, we need him. So then they made him the Deputy Secretary General. But we know he was doing more work as the Secretary General of the ANC.
Was this under Mr. Mzo?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And then he became the Director of International Affairs of the ANC. That's how he starts going to...
all
over the world. Yes.
Yeah.
Thabo Mbeki later on took up the position.
Yes. Yeah.
So Thabo Mbeki, as I stated earlier, he was trained or was mentored by Mr. Nokwe.
Yeah.
And he died in 1978.
That's correct.
At the time of his death, where was he staying?
Lusaka. The thing that was interesting is that it was 1978, right, January, I was expecting my first child. So, and January the 8th, Tata was sort of like an MC or directing the program, you know, and Utatu Tambo was there. And, I mean, he was at his peak, you know, and he was so good, you know. And little did we know that he was ill, you know. And that was January the 8th. And then he fell ill that night. And I think each one of us, I think each of the children had a moment with him. My sister, who is a physiotherapy, Vulazana, massaged him that night. He said, yeah, he has got a back pain or something. And then he was vomiting in the evening, and I was looking at, and I just said to mom, look, we have to take him to the hospital. But, you know, he was so distracted. He said, no, I have a toothache. I need to go to the dentist. And dun, dun, dun. So, but fortunately, because I had worked at UTH, at the University Teaching Hospital in Lusaka, I then took him quickly and then got him admitted, and I went to look for one of my, you know, mentors, doctors, and said, look, my dad is ill, very ill. And little did we know, because he, all he said, look, he wanted fish, because he loved fish, for lunch. And we went to the market, picked up fish. Then when we got home, Auntie Mgabaza, one of the nurses, South African nurses, was working at the UTH, came running, you know, I can imagine, from the UTH where we were staying, it was quite a distance. Said, look, Tiny, leave everything you're doing, come back. That was now 11th of January, I've forgotten the date.
12th,
yeah. I always think it's the 11th. You know. So he, Auntie Mgabaza, and I'm saying, okay, I'm coming. They said, no, not you. Then I knew that it wasn't good. So our cousin, Mpumi, went with Auntie Mgabaza, but I just went berserk. I just thought, look, this is it, you know. So he passed away.
So he was buried in Lusaka.
Yeah.
Who attended his funeral? Who made speeches there?
Ooh. Joshua Nkomo.
We're talking about a big man, I mean, yes. Your father.
You see, when he passed away, and of course Uncle O.R. was also, you know, he almost went crazy because they were working on this Harare manifesto. And he just said, apparently, no, not Duma. And, of course, traditionally we have to wait for his parents. He was a one and only child. They were coming from South Africa. How they were coming, because all the avenues were closed to them immediately. The regime closed the airport, the buses, whatever, I don't know. Clandestine, I still have to ask Auntie Natsu how she made it to Botswana. And then in Botswana they got a chartered flight. And that's how they got to Lusaka. But I think this was on the 22nd, I remember. Oh, 20th, yeah?
20, yeah, yeah, the funeral was on the 22nd.
January. By then, Mommy had it. You know, she just said, look, let's bury him, you know. Because people, you know, thronged the house, you know, went in and out. It was raining, cats and dogs. It was amazing. It wasn't even the rainy season. It was raining. So, just, you know, the ceremony, Utatu O.R. gave the keynote address, and we closed the coffin, people had viewed, and, we were just about to take him to the cemetery. In comes his parents.
Wow. Mm.
Then you can imagine, elderly.
Open again.
Yeah.
We had to go back, open the coffin, and very traumatic experience, but... Yeah.
And Joshua Nkomo
came over from, was still in exile. Because that was before Zimbabwe attained its own independence. Yeah.
Thabo Mbeki can actually quote the speech that Joshua Nkomo gave. It was really a fabulous speech that he gave there, because they worked together, and then there were comrades from, his comrades from Frelimo, MPLA, ZAPU.
Yeah.
All the liberation movements, SWAPO, all the liberation movements were very strongly represented at this.
How old were you then?
I was 16.
She was just writing her matric.
Yeah.
Also called matric.
Yeah. No, they call it matric.
Call it O-levels.
O-levels. Yes. Mm. And later on, when did that happen? I'm sure that they're going to enlighten us there. His remains were...
Yeah, his remains
moved to South Africa.
Not yet.
It hasn't happened.
No.
Are there plans afoot to do that?
Yes. You know, as mom, you know, and I think grandmother and them came over and then said, you know what? Where the soldier has fallen, let him be buried there. So that was the notion. Up until Nosizwe, I don't know how. She had must have been having a premonition about Umama. Mama went to view the grave for the last time. And that changed the dynamics, because she said, okay, that changed the dynamics. And she said, look, we have to take Daddy back home. And we were on that program 2008. we approached the ANC and, you know, then they said, look, we don't have the money. So, but we just worked on a program. We said, okay, we'll try and get that body, or the mortal remains back. But what happened? Oh, yeah. Then we were preparing for him, not knowing that, yeah, our mommy passed away.
Oh, you see.
So it threw a spanner into our old plans. We
at the time, your mom was in South Africa.
No, he had come back. Yes.
That was which year?
2008.
Yeah.
2008.
October the 24th, the day of the independence of Zambia. So funny.
Yeah, it was a nice coincidence, isn't it?
It's amazing, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Please tell me about the Duma Nokwe Foundation.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, the Duma Nokwe Foundation, I think we, when all these things were happening post liberation or independence, we sat down and thought, look, we have to keep this legacy of our father going. Actually, it's supposed to be Duma and Vuyiswa Nokwe Foundation, but somehow, because the whole focus was on the legal matters. And if there is the Duma Nokwe Chambers in Sandton, which was started, when was it? Way back, where this legal group fraternity realized that, look, they will have to kind of emulate what Daddy went through. Because you know how it is in law. You know, you have to, you know, give in your what do they call those special things that you have to do, the book
pupillage.
And they thought, look, and it's expensive, you know, to run a chambers or something like that, so they created this. Advocate Patrick Mshaulane was leading that, and they did ask permission from our mother, you know. Mommy said fine. But then we realized that, look, we're missing something here, so we need to have something that is firm as a foundation for them, you know, as a legacy. So then it started, you know, and we partnered also with UNISA so that, you know, we can channel some of the, you know, young students or, you know, work with them in the moot courts and, you know, anything that has to do with it. It's not been, you know, sort of smooth riding, but at the head of this Duma Nokwe Foundation is our brother, our baby brother, Uvikela Rankin.
Advocate Nokwe was a friend too and colleague of Advocate Bizos. The latter had been born in Greece and came to South Africa as a refugee in 1941. He settled in the city of Johannesburg. As a lawyer, he represented Mr. Nelson Mandela and his comrades in various political cases, including the Rivonia trial, which culminated in Mandela and other leaders of the liberation movement being sentenced to lengthy prison sentences. Mr. Bizos spent the rest of his life doggedly fighting for the rights of the oppressed people in South Africa and Africa.
How this the George Bizos story comes about, it's quite interesting because him and George Bizos, they met at university, at Wits. He was studying there, but because of the Group Areas Act, he couldn't be seen in certain places after a certain time. So George Bizos, the late Uncle George Bizos, tells the story that he was sleeping in the library because he couldn't go home, but he needed to read. So this thing that the issue that my sister was talking about his love for reading, in a funny way, I mean, he could have slept anywhere else, but he was sleeping
of all places, yeah, just the library.
Yeah, in the library. Yeah. And then one day George Bizos comes into the library and it's late and he sees him there and he's busy pulling out of his suitcase. He had his case, and he pulls out a sandwich and he's having his dinner. So George Bizos says, what are you doing? He says, oh, no, I'm just having my dinner. He says, why don't you go somewhere else to have it? He said, because this is where I'm going to sleep. And he opens the bag, and in his bag there's his books, a blanket to cover himself and his sandwich and so on.
Yeah.
And that's when George Bizos said he realized that he didn't know that there was such a situation that, you know, existed. So the friendship starts there, and for many nights he would come there and bring his fish and chips, and they'll sit there at the back behind and, you know, start having their discussions and so on.
As students before they became lawyers.
As students before. Yes. That is from when they knew each other.
Yes.
And then when now George Bizos was now an advocate in his, at His Majesty's chambers, and then Duma Noke now becomes the first African advocate to be admitted into the Transvaal Bar, now there is nowhere for him to practice because of, again, Group Areas Act. So it was Maisels and him who conspired to say, listen, we, Maisels says he was the head of the
Advocate Maisels.
Yes, Advocate Maisels. Yes. He was the head of the whatever, the group there.
Okay.
So he says, listen, in the meeting, I'm going to bring this issue up to say, what are we going to do about Duma Noko? He is an advocate and he's a colleague. What are we going to do about it? And he says, you must then volunteer. So they plan this whole thing. He says, I'm going to point at you so that you don't get into trouble and people don't say you are the one. So I'll point at you. So anyway, the meeting happens and he says, what are we going to do about Duma Noko? And then everybody looks at each other. Everybody's uncomfortable because group areas and apartheid, and he actually shouldn't be here. And then Maisels looks at George Bizos and says, Advocate Bizos, and he says, well, he can share my rooms.
Yes.
So that's the story he tells. But what he also tells, the story that he told was that he had a huge influence on him. Because now he's sharing his rooms, and every evening now, he can't go home because group areas again. He can't get on a bus to go back to Soweto. And he ends up sleeping in the rooms. And then George Bizos himself now starts to sleep with him there as well.
Yeah.
So he says late into the night they'd have their dinner, they'd chat and discuss. And he said he had such a huge impact on him in terms of him deciding to become a human rights activist and advocate.
Yes, that's interesting.
Yeah. He said that was the huge influence that he got from him. He said the way he cared about the plight of the people, and many cases that he actually took, he wasn't even paid for, because people could not afford to pay him. But he took the cases, and he would fight for the people.
Yeah.
And that's what Uncle George Bizos says. For him, this was a remarkable human being. And as my sister said, every time he saw us, he would cry. He said, what a remarkable person your father was.
Did he used to visit Mr. Noko after Mr. Noko had gone to exile?
So that's
Mr. Bizos.
That's the story he also tells. Yeah. He says now, he came to Lusaka. You see, when the talks about talks started, but unfortunately, our father was late by then.
Yes, that was in the late 1980s.
Yeah.
And going to the early 1990s.
Correct. Yes. And he says he came to Lusaka. And again, when he tells the story, he breaks down. He says, to find that Duma Noko, you know, had passed on was very sad for me. But he came to our home in Lilanda, where we were staying, to meet, to come and be with our mother.
Yes, thank
and
you.
To see her. And in fact, when we came back to South Africa, he was one of the people that was very eager to meet with our mother, 1992. And he came to Cape Town and he met with her and he said to her, from now on, Tiny, don't worry. I will look after you and the children. Because when our father, he tells the story, George Bizos, when our father was leaving into exile, remember, my sister said people just used to disappear when they go. But he came to His Majesty's building and he called him into one of those rooms there and he said to him, George, I have to leave.
Yes.
Uncle George tells that story. I have to leave. And he says, do me a favor, look after Tiny and the children. And that was it. He said he never saw him again. But that is why when he came, when we came back to South Africa, he came to South Africa, to Cape Town. And he said, I will look after you and the children. I promise, Duma.
A good man, George Bizos was.
I promise, Duma.
I had an honor of meeting him a few times. Yes.
And before he passed, he kept saying to us, I need to see all of Duma's grandchildren, because Duma never saw his grandchildren.
How many does he have, by the way?
How many are they?
Really?
They are 11.
11,
yeah. So he said...
The whole soccer team.
Yes. So that's 11 that are, let's say, genetically his grandchildren. But there are more who are not genetically. In other words, because we have so many, our families open. So he said, I need to see all of Duma's grandchildren. And he kept insisting. And then we had a lunch a year before he passed away.
Mm.
And we organized this lunch at our home. All his children came, all of us with plus our children, plus the extended family. And we had this wonderful, wonderful lunch. And he spoke to each and everyone.
Mm.
Who are you? What do you do? What do you want to be? Do you know my story with your grandfather?
Mm.
He said. And he spoke to each child. And then he said, when he was leaving, he said, I'm happy now. I will tell Duma I met all his grandchildren.
Ah, God bless.
Yeah.
Mr. Bezos.
Yes.
Yes. What else, Mama?
Yeah, what else? These men were great. I mean, they laid the foundation for us. And we are what we are today because of them. And also the emphasis always has been education, education, education. And I would just recount the story of I studied in Germany. I'm a medical doctor. And my other sister, Uzana, is a physiotherapist. I was 17, she was 15. And then when we were leaving that day, Utata just... Daddy was not somebody who'd scold you, but he gives you that look if you've done something amiss.
Stern look.
Yes, stern look. And... what's his name? When we were leaving, then he says, don't bring me walking certificates.
What's that now?
Exactly. Now, this is a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old. We were puzzled up until I got to Germany. And, of course, in Germany, you have to do the language, because we had to do it in German. So at the language school, there were these friends from Eritrea. Everybody's there. Then there was this Muhammad Idris, and then Mohammed and I, got on well, we could intellectually engage and dun, dun. Ha! The following morning I said, Mohammed, whatever we started yesterday, finish the class. Don't want in. No. Why? No. I said, I don't want babies.
Yes.
It just hit me home,
Now so, I see, yes.
Because, you see, parents are wonderful people that give you guidance. They don't have to beat you up or anything. They just have to say a few short words and you remember,
Yes.
So that way I just remember that message.
Mama Elia, you told me about what Mr. Chisano, who's the former president of Mozambique,
yes,
once what you once said about your father,
yes.
Mr. Tumanogwe.
Yes. So I was in Mozambique. I'd gone to work there. And he came to our stand where we were doing an exhibition. Then our mother was there. She was sitting next to me at the stand. And when he saw her, he said, tiny? Tiny Nokwe. And then they were so happy to see each other. And then he told his delegation, he said, do you know who this is? This is Tiny Nokwe. She's the widow of Duma Nokwe. Duma Nokwe, he gives them the story, the secretary general of the ANC and so on. And he says, what a man. He said, that gentleman was instrumental in our liberation movement. He used to advise us and he used to write our speeches for us. Because we Portuguese speaking, we have to go to the UN, we have to go internationally. But every time we went to him, Comrade Duma, can you help us? And he said, sit down. What is the issue? And he wrote all our speeches and he said, what fantastic English that he used to write. And also, he said he was such a worker. He could work overnight. And he used to always advise us in terms of our diplomatic strategy. And that is how he contributed to the liberation of this country, Mozambique. That's what he said.
Mr. Chissano was the president.
He was the president at that time. He was the president at that time.
Okay.
And in fact, when Mozambique got freedom, our father was invited to Mozambique, and he went for those independence celebrations, and used to go very frequently, obviously, after that, because Mozambique worked very, Frelimo and the ANC, they worked hand in hand. And Marcelino dos Santos, the late, also very, very complimentary about the role that Duma Nokwe played in terms of the solidarity between the African National Congress and Frelimo in terms of the fight for liberation. Because all these liberation movements, they worked together.
Mm-hmm.
Even the MPLA, Frelimo, SWAPO, ZAPU, they were working together in terms of the liberation struggle.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.